You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Well, good morning, everyone. It is delightful to see all those in Washington who are not obsessed with a certain hearing taking place a little further down the road. But it's no more joyful occasion for me than a day when we get to launch a new book by a Brookings colleague. It really is at the heart of what we do, and I'm delighted to share this day with all of you. And this book is, I think, a particularly trenchant one for the present moment, for reasons I'll explain in a minute. In his years at Brookings, Bruce has written millions of words, all of them cogent and clear. He's published 7 books here now, but this book is a bit different, I think it's fair to say, because it blends a personal narrative from Bruce's own childhood with the story of how America began its military engagement in the Middle East. So Beirut 1958, How America's Wars in the Middle East Began, a book I devoured over the last week and which you can purchase just outside if you haven't already done so. This is a book that helps illuminate not only the origins of America's military engagements in the region, but the origins of Bruce's engagement with the region. And this is a time of transition for the United States, for the region itself, but for the United States in this region. It's a time when big questions are being asked about why the United States should care about what happens in the Middle East, how much we should care, and what we should or should not be prepared to do about that. And I think that this book, by going back to the beginning, helps us answer some of those questions. You know, when I was in graduate school working for my mentor, Chris Joyner, we had a joke when we were trying to come up with titles for our articles. We would call them, whatever the subject was on, colon, looking back to see ahead. So international terrorism and U.S. policy, looking back to see ahead. And this was a great sort of go-to because, of course, often in times of transition, it's useful to look back, see where you've been, how you got to where you are, and where you should go from here. And so it's perhaps unsurprising that there have been a bunch of histories published in recent years about the great powers in the Middle East, about the early years of American involvement in the Middle East, and a couple of them previously have come out of this institution, Khaled al-Gindi's magnificent Blind Spot on the History of the U.S. Relationship with the Palestinians, and Mike Doran's Ike's Gamble about the 1956 Suez Crisis. Bruce's book is different in this way as well. It looks at a moment that's often neglected or sort of quickly skipped over in the history of American engagement in this region. And yet, as Bruce's narrative reveals, it is highly symbolic and highly significant. I really couldn't be more delighted to be part of celebrating this publication by our fantastic colleague, Bruce Riedel. You all have his bio in front of you, as well as the bio of Suzanne Maloney, who will be our discussant and interviewer this morning. So I don't need to tell you a lot about them. I will just tell you that Bruce is not only a senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy, he is the director of our intelligence project, and he is a veteran of 30 years of service in the CIA, including time overseas in the region, and time working for 4 different presidents in the White House. He brings all of that insight and experience, as well as the clear writing habits of an intelligence officer, to this manuscript. And I know that you'll enjoy hearing from him in just a moment. Joining him on stage this morning to help explore the book's themes further is Suzanne Maloney. Suzanne is the deputy director of our foreign policy program and another cherished colleague, senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy, as well as our energy, security, and climate initiative. She has long focused on Iran and Persian Gulf energy and served as an advisor both in the State Department and in the energy sector. So with no further words from me, I'd like to ask you to join me in welcoming Bruce to the stage.
Thank you for that very kind introduction, Tammy, and thank all of you for choosing to be here instead of watching TV and chanting, "Lock 'em up." Around 3 p.m. in the afternoon of July 15, 1958, 1,500 Marines from the 2nd Battalion of the 2nd Marine Regiment stormed the beach just south of Beirut International Airport. Offshore, there were more than 70 warships from the United States 6th Fleet, including three carrier battle groups. Back in the United States, the 82nd Airborne Division was on high alert, ready to deploy to the region if necessary. The Marines were expecting to run into D-Day. They thought they were about to face the Wehrmacht. As you can see here, they were armed, loaded, and ready to fight. Instead, they ran into Lebanese and foreign tourists sunbathing on the beach. Lebanon in 1958 was in the middle of a civil war, but it was also the Paris of the Middle East, the nicest place to live. You could go literally swimming in the morning and skiing in the afternoon or the other way around. It had the best restaurants. It had all the best places to go. It had the American University of Beirut. So as the Marines stormed ashore, the sunbathers ran out of the way, and the Lebanese vendors came running down to the shore to sell shawarma, Coca-Cola, cigarettes, and Lebanese teenagers ran down to the shore to help the Marines unload. Here you can see the crowds watching intently. It all had a kind of comic opera aspect to it, but it was deadly serious. In West Germany, the United States had a battalion of rocket launchers ready with nuclear devices that were about to be airlifted to the beachhead just in case nuclear weapons were needed. In the end, they were never sent. I have searched vainly for 2 years for a picture of somebody in a bikini on the beach. I can tell you, you can't find it. This is as close as I was able to come. This was, as Tammy suggested already, the first combat operation by the United States in the Middle East. When those troops went ashore that day, nobody in the United States, nobody in the Middle East recognized that it was the dawn of a new era of what now seems to be endless wars in the Middle East, wars that never seem to come to conclusions. We've gone back to Beirut since 1958 with much more tragic outcomes. A few hours after the troops went ashore, President Dwight David Eisenhower came on national television to speak to the nation. This was almost exactly a year after Eisenhower had laid out what we now call the Eisenhower Doctrine. The Eisenhower Doctrine was the first time an American president said the Middle East is vital to American national interests. No president had ever said that before. He identified two things that were vital in the Middle East: oil, the obvious one, and that the Middle East was the birthplace of the three great monotheistic religions, and that if the Middle East fell to atheistic communism, those monotheistic religions would somehow be threatened by all of it. It's very interesting that Ike did not list the survival of Israel or the preservation of Israel as a vital national interest. No American president since, obviously, would do that. Ike was now talking about why he had sent the troops in, and he invoked what had gone on in Baghdad the day before. On the 14th of July, 1958, Iraq was stunned by an extremely violent coup carried out by a brigade of the Iraqi army. The coup resulted in the death, murder of the king of Iraq, of the crown prince, and the day later, the prime minister of Iraq, Nouri al-Said, one of the most famous politicians in the Middle East. In his speech to the American people, Eisenhower only briefly alluded to the thing that was really on his mind, this man, Gamal Abdel Nasser, the charismatic president of Egypt in 1958. Ike spent most of the speech not talking about the dangers of Arab nationalism or coups in the Middle East. He spent most of the speech talking about the Soviet Union, that if the United States didn't respond to events in the Middle East today, it would be worse than the fall of China to communism in 1948, worse than the start of the Cold War in Europe, and would be much like Munich in 1938, setting the stage for a Third World War. Eisenhower didn't talk about Nasser, but Nasser was really on his mind. The coup in Iraq looked like it was the fulfillment of Nasser's calls for Arab unity. We've kind of forgotten about Arab nationalism and Arab unity in this century, but in the previous century, it was one of the most animating ideologies in the world. Nasser was the symbol of that movement. He was incredibly charismatic. He was a marvelous speaker. Early on in his life, he was giving a speech in Alexandria. An assassin's bullet went flying by his face, and he just kept talking, demonstrating a manhood that was very, very powerful in those days. He, of course, had been the winner of the 1956 Suez Crisis, defeating England, France, and Israel. Eisenhower had something to do with that, but Nasser didn't really give him off much credit. In February of 1958, Egypt and Syria had united into the United Arab Republic. The UAR appeared to be the first step in the unification of the Arab world from the ocean to the Gulf, that is, from Morocco to Oman. It's ironic that Nasser's entry into politics was very much facilitated by the United States. Nasser was a student of one of the most famous American spies of all time, Kermit Roosevelt. Kermit Roosevelt, the scion of the Roosevelt family, is famous in retrospect largely for the 1953 coup in Iraq that removed Mohammad Mossadegh and put the Shah back in power. He was actually more important to the Eisenhower administration as the man who helped Nasser consolidate power. The United States in the early 1950s, the beginning of the Eisenhower administration, very much wanted to link itself to Arab nationalism, seeing this as a barrier to the encroachment of communism. That wore off over time, largely because the United States refused to provide the Egyptians with money to buy arms, and they ended up going to the Soviets through Czechoslovakia to get their arms. At one point early on in the relationship between Kermit Roosevelt and Nasser, the United States did, the CIA did provide a small amount of cash to Nasser, about $5 million. Nasser ironically used it to build the radio transmitter for his radio network, the Voice of the Arabs. The Voice of the Arabs was the equivalent of Twitter today. It was the most successful way of communicating with people. And the radio tower was nicknamed in Cairo Roosevelt's Erection, in a little bit of honor of Roosevelt's role. I won't go into the details of that any more than necessary. As I said, in February of 1958, Syria and Egypt united in the United Arab Republic. In response to that, the Hashemite kingdoms of Jordan and Iraq, both run by Hashemite rulers, united as well. On the 3rd of March 1958, King Saud of Saudi Arabia, another American ally, told the American ambassador that Nasser would soon be overthrown in a coup. Actually, what he was alluding to was a plot by the Saudis to blow up Nasser's airplane in flight and kill him and everyone else on board. Unfortunately, 48 hours later, Nasser came on television to announce that they had foiled the coup and that the King Saud was behind it, and he had the stamped checks from King Saud that proved he was supporting the assassination plot. pretty sloppy tradecraft, as we would say in the CIA. You never put your own name on the check, but in this case it was. Saud had been the favorite of President Eisenhower. Saud was, in Eisenhower's mind, the perfect anecdote to Nasser. We would have a more religious, a more Islamic version of nationalism. Unfortunately, Saud was a drunk. He was terrible at gambling. He lost a fortune in gambling, and he was a very lousy ruler for Egypt. He was the first Saudi king to ever visit the United States. He came in 1957. The visit was planned for 3 days. It turned into 7 days. The number of people he brought was so large that the Saudi security forces had to be housed in tents on Lafayette Park. I can't imagine a presidential visit like this. Modern presidencies just do not have a visit that goes twice as long as it was planned to be, but that did. None of this, of course, helped Saud after the foiling and the uncovery of the plot to kill Nasser. The Saudi royal family quickly stripped Saud of all of his political powers. He remained king in name only. All of the political power moved to Crown Prince Faisal. It would take 5 more years before Faisal actually moved the king out of office, but the American protege, King Saud, was essentially powerless from then on. This seemed like another setback to United States interests. In the summer, beginning of the summer, the Central Intelligence Agency also detected a coup plot against King Hussein. This is King Hussein with his cousin, King Faisal. You can see they were both incredibly young in 1958. The plot in on Jordan was orchestrated by the former defense attaché of Jordan in the United States. The FBI had caught him on the phone talking to his Egyptian counterpart about overthrowing the king. The CIA used that information and gave it to King Hussein, which was able to foil the plot. But it seemed like another example that the Middle East was falling apart and that it was all going Nasser's way. The king asked the Iraqis, his cousin, to send a brigade to Amman, Jordan, in order to help buttress his regime. He was fearful of his own military. The brigade moved through the city of Baghdad on the night of 13-14 July. It was supposed to be heading to the Jordanian border. Instead, it went to the Ministry of Defense and the Royal Palace and seized power. King Faisal, as I said, was brutally murdered, as was the Crown Prince. The United States knew virtually nothing about what was going on in this coup plot. The coup plot identified themselves as being led by Lieutenant Colonel Abdel Karim Qasem. Nobody had ever heard of Abdel Karim al-Qasem in the United States or in the United Kingdom, which was very close to Iraq. It was assumed that this was a Nasserite coup, and if you look at this picture, you can understand why. Pictures of Nasser were everywhere in the crowds, which was celebrating the overthrow of the Hashemite monarchy. The tanks that had seized the royal palace all had pictures of Nasser on the outside. Eisenhower then convened a meeting of his National Security Council late on the day of July 14th as the news came in. And he turned, of course, to, this is Lieutenant Colonel Qasem, we'll come back to him in a minute. He was the leader of the plot. Eisenhower turned to his director of Central Intelligence, Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles painted a picture of a Middle East on the verge of explosion. He said that every pro-Western government in the Arab world was likely to fall to Nasserism in the next week or so unless the United States did something, that Israel would then find itself surrounded by a hostile Arab world and would almost certainly take the West Bank and East Jerusalem, creating a crisis between Arabs and Israelis, and that the source of oil for Western Europe, not so much for the United States, but for Western Europe, would be in grave danger. The Soviets, of course, would be the ones who gained the most from all of this. Alan Dulles's brother, John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, chimed in, as he always did, painting a picture of the Soviet Union on the brink of controlling the entire world. Ike responded that we have to do something. What are we going to do? Planning had been underway for months already about going into Beirut. Lebanon was in the midst of a civil war. The civil war was a result of a number of things, one of which was the incredible attraction of the United Arab Republic for Lebanese Muslims. In the February and March of 1958, when the UAR was first set up, Nasser came to Damascus and he came to the other cities of Syria and was met by adoring crowds. Among the people in those crowds were 350,000 Lebanese. Lebanon only had a population of 1.2 million people. You can see that almost 10%, more than 10% of the population actually traveled to another country to cheer on Nasser. The president of Lebanon in 1958 was this man, Camille Chamoun. You can see he's a natty dresser, to put it mildly, a Maronite. The president of Lebanon then, as now, had to be a Maronite Catholic. The prime minister was a Sunni Muslim. The speaker of the house is a Shia Muslim. Chamoun wanted to stay in office a second term. That was not strictly illegal, but it was against protocol. Lebanese presidents had never done that before. And he whipped up support in the Christian community for him staying in a second term by painting the Muslim community as basically traitors who were falling into the hands of the Egyptians. Chamoun had asked for support. He'd begged the Eisenhower administration for months to send in troops to shore him up. The American ambassador in Beirut consistently told the White House that there was no reason to send American troops in, that the problem could be resolved diplomatically. It was not strictly a Christian-Muslim fight. The patriarch of the Maronite Church, for example, was on the side of the Muslims in calling for Chamoun to step down from office. So it was more complicated than strictly Christian versus Muslim. But nonetheless, it was seen in Washington as a conflict painting Nasserism against forces of the West. And so Eisenhower decided to send troops to Lebanon. He deliberately decided not to send troops to Iraq. We don't know exactly why he made that decision, but I think it's safe to say that Eisenhower is the hero of D-Day, a man who had commanded more American troops in combat than anyone else, recognized that going to Baghdad was a dangerous thing to do, whereas going into Beirut was a relatively simple operation for the Marines. Nasser immediately went from Egypt to Moscow via Yugoslavia. It was a secret trip at first. He consulted with the Russians about what was going on. Both Nasser and Khrushchev agreed that they'd never heard of Abdel Karim al-Qassem before. They had no idea what was going on in Iraq, but that Iraq was where the real action was, and what the Americans were doing in Beirut was kind of a sideshow that didn't really matter very much. It was a sideshow, but it could have become deadly. The Muslim community saw the Marines, rightly, as coming to the defense of Chamoun, and therefore as the enemies of their movement. The Lebanese army, which was composed of Christians and Muslims, mostly Christians as officers and Muslims as GIs, saw the Marines as an invading force that had violated Lebanese sovereignty, which indeed it had, and it was their responsibility to fight them. Chamoun, of course, was calling on the Marines to immediately come to the presidential palace, which he had been essentially holed up in for more than a month, free him and take over the country. It could have easily turned into a massive firefight. Fortunately, the American ambassador on the scene, this man here, Robert McClintock, kept his cool. McClintock went to the head of the Lebanese army, Fuad Shahab. He's the man sitting here on closer to me, a Maronite, and said, why don't we do this? Why don't we pretend that the Marines have been invited here by the Lebanese army and that you are their hosts and they are their guests? and you will escort them as they move around town. But of course, we actually won't let them move around town. We'll just keep them at the airport and at the beachhead and avoid any possibility of interaction between them and the Muslim community. Shahab, who was a very smart man, agreed, and so the pretense was created that the Marines weren't there as an invasion, they were there as the guests of the Lebanese army. It allowed a window of opportunity to develop. McClintock then began working on the Lebanese political problem, on the dispute over Shamoun's staying in office. He was assisted by the Undersecretary of State, Robert Murphy. It's pretty clear that Murphy initially was sent to Beirut because the Eisenhower administration thought McClintock was off the farm and that he was being too friendly to the Muslims. Once Murphy got to Beirut, he quickly understood that, in fact, McClintock was the one who was reading it right and was the one who was going to find a way to solve the problem. In the end, Murphy and McClintock, working together, engineered the removal of Camille Shamoun from the presidency and his replacement by, of course, Fuad Shahab. That was exactly what Nasser had always wanted from the beginning. And he had told the Americans from the beginning that the solution to the problem was to elevate Shahab into the office. Murphy also went on from Beirut after he'd engineered this to Baghdad. He met Colonel Qasem, and it became very apparent to him very, very quickly that Colonel Qasem was an Iraqi nationalist, not the stooge of the Egyptians and certainly not the stooge of the Soviet Union. He wanted to run Iraq for Iraqis. And he promised to protect American equities in Iraq. The Marines left Beirut by the fall. The last Marine left on October 25, 1958. Operation Blue Bat, as it was called, was over. One GI was killed in combat in the Operation Blue Bat. He died in sniper fire. As I said, this was the first American combat operation in the Middle East. A couple of decades later, the United States went back to Beirut in 1982. That mission ended after 241 Marines were killed in the bombing of their barracks at Beirut International Airport. In 2003, of course, we finally did get to Baghdad. 4,424 Americans were killed in that operation. There are many lessons to be learned, I think, from looking back at Operation Blue Bat and the first combat operation. The simplest and most important is don't panic. The Middle East is full of unpleasant surprises. Almost every morning there is bad news from the Middle East. Suicide car bombings, you name it, assassinations. Something bad is always happening. Chill out. By tomorrow, something else will be happening. You don't have to, quote, do something in response to every bad news in the Middle East. That's not to say that every American military operation in the Middle East has been a mistake. Obviously, some of them have been imperative, important. We had to respond to the events of 9/11. We rightly responded to the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1990. But you don't always need to press the troop button as your first place to respond. Let me say one more thing. As Tammy alluded to earlier, this was also my maiden voyage into the Middle East. In 1958, I was 5 years old. My father worked for the United Nations. We had first been posted to East Jerusalem, then part of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. We were there through the 1956 crisis, and in 1957, we moved to the Paris of the Middle East, Beirut. There I am. I'm the shorter one. That's my brother, I think, trying desperately to say I have no idea who this person is next to me. You can see I'm dressed in Native American attire. And here I am flying my first helicopter mission for the United Nations in 1958. With that, let me stop and welcome Suzanne to the floor.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you all for coming to join us here today for this conversation. I'm going to take the prerogative of the moderator to pose a few questions to Bruce to kick things off, but then we'll be turning the mics over to you in just a few minutes. So please tee up some questions or comments that you'd like to share in just a few moments. But I wanted to start, Bruce, with one of the themes that comes through in this book that I find is often a set of issues that in the contemporary discussion in the Middle East, we almost conveniently have forgotten. Just the power of ideologies, which are now essentially defunct. We spend a lot of time thinking about ideology when it comes to the Middle East today, but it's often in the context of Islamism, of other extremist ideologies. The ideologies that you talked about in the context of this crisis, both the sort of omnipresent threat of communism and the extent to which that directed American responses to developments in the region, but also the powerful pull of Arab nationalism within the region and, again, in the way that people here in Washington responded. I wondered if you'd talk a little bit more about the significance of those and is there anything that we can take away from the fact that this is now essentially the dustbin of history? When I talk to students today, the concept that a fear of the Soviet Union motivated our responses to events in the Middle East almost seems absurd. What can we take away from the power of those ideologies and the extent to which we are still, in to some extent, in a similar but different trap today?
Sure. It is now more than 20 years since the fall of the Soviet Union. We have been celebrating that, the calming down of the Berlin Wall. For those who didn't live through that time, it's hard to understate how much life was dominated by the struggle, perceived struggle, between the United States and the Soviet Union. We not only developed the two world's largest nuclear arsenals, with the capacity to destroy mankind 100 times over had we ever used them, and had the constant threat that nuclear war could break out. But we were literally at war with what we saw as Russia's protégés around the world, from Korea to Vietnam, in the Middle East. And everything was seen through this prism. And I have to say, in the Eisenhower administration, particularly the second term of the Eisenhower administration, it was more than ever. The Suez Crisis of 1556, the Hungarian crisis that accompanied it, had set in the president's mind and in his cabinet's mind that we were now at the win or lose moment of the Cold War. And that ideology, of course, continued over into the next administration, the Kennedy administration. John F. Kennedy's famous inaugural address is really about calling upon Americans to be ready to fight communism around the world. We've kind of reinterpreted it more gentle in years since, but that's what Kennedy was talking about. He was going to be a more aggressive and more intelligent pursuit of the Cold War, but he was still pursuing the Cold War. That ideology prism was enormous. The one that we've even forgotten more, though, is Arab nationalism. The modern Arab states of the Middle East, particularly the ones of the so-called Fertile Crescent, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Kuwait, Jordan, are artificial creations. Now, Jordan is a completely artificial country. You just look at the lines on the map. The borders of Jordan are drawn by a ruler. They were drawn by Winston Churchill one afternoon after a conference in Cairo in which he had one too many Arab princes left over. He had to find a country for Emir Abdullah. He'd already given Iraq to his brother Faisal. They had to find something for Abdullah, so he created Jordan out of whole cloth. Those countries had very little in the way of real nationalist standing. Nobody thought of themselves as a Jordanian nationalist in the 1950s, not even the king. The king saw himself as heir to the former kingdom of the Hejaz, and someday they would return not just with Jordan, but with Syria, Lebanon, Palestine into a larger Arab network. That idea of Arab nationalism was very, very powerful and very, very popular. And Nasser was the perfect person to lead it. Young, charismatic, very fluent, a great speaker, inspiring, and in the 1950s, looking like everything was going his way. We now know that 10 years later, everything had gone terribly wrong. He'd blundered into a civil war in Yemen that bogged down the Egyptian army in the mid-1960s, which led to it being in the wrong desert at the wrong time in the 1967 war and the shattering defeat. And the 1967 war really was the end of Arab nationalism as a powerful motivating force, to be replaced by Palestinian nationalism, Iraqi nationalism, and movements like that.
Thank you. One of the takeaways that I had in reading your book and in hearing your presentation is just around the power of individuals in terms of shaping history, both for good and for ill. And you talk about some of the sort of well-known headline names, whether it's Eisenhower or Nasser, but you also talk about individual figures who themselves played critical roles in avoiding the worst possible outcome here. And I think that, in particular, the role of the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon as a force for good. We often look back on our mistakes in the Middle East and fail to appreciate how it is individuals have, in fact, averted worse disasters. I wonder if you could speak to that issue of Americans who actually have sought, at different points in time, to move our policy in a more sensible direction.
Let me start with Eisenhower. July 14th was really an anomaly in the Eisenhower administration. Eisenhower was elected as, of course, the hero of D-Day, the man who had led the, quote, crusade in Europe. We wouldn't use the term crusade ever anywhere in this century, but in the 1940s and 50s, it was okay to call it the crusade in Europe. Although he spent his entire career in the military, Eisenhower actually never served in combat himself. He led people in combat, but he was never in a situation with live fire going on around him. He was either always a staff officer or later on becoming commander-in-chief of Allied forces. He was risk-averse. He didn't like risky situations. The first thing he did as becoming president was he found a way to wind down the war in Korea and bring the Korean War to an end through a ceasefire. He refused to take on the advice of his great alter ego in the Second World War, Douglas MacArthur, and use atomic weapons against the communist Chinese. With the exception of Operation Blue Bat, he never sent American forces into a combat situation in the 8 years that he was in office. He was also a very religious man. He's the only president who was ever baptized while he was in the White House. And when he talked about the three great religions, monotheistic religions coming from the Middle East, I think that was a real insight into his character. This was an extremely religious man who wanted to do the right thing, who saw communism as an evil thing. He panicked on the 14th of July, probably in part because by then he'd already had two heart attacks in office. It was only after the second heart attack that he gave up smoking cigarettes. Back, of course, in the 1950s, everybody smoked cigarettes. Ike had a habit of going through two or three packs a day. Most of the cigarettes he lit, took one puff, put in the tray, and never went back to. But nonetheless, if you do that with 30 cigarettes, that's certainly not going to be very good for your health. The man on the scene was very different. McClintock was a seasoned American diplomat. He'd spent his whole career in diplomacy. He would go on to other important posts after this. And he was an expert on the region. And he was an expert on Lebanese politics in particular. Lebanese politics then and now is an incredibly confusing situation. I like remembering when I first started at the CIA back in the 1970s, my first account was Lebanon, and I can remember going to brief people, and you could see after about 2 or 3 minutes that their faces were just glazed over. What do you mean? Right-wing, left-wing, Muslim, Christian, Palestinian terrorist group? How's that different from a left-wing, right-wing Muslim terrorist group? They all seem to be the same. McClintock understood all of those dynamics, and he particularly understood that Lebanese Muslim leaders did not really want to become part of the United Arab Republic. If you were the leader of the Lebanese Sunni community, you were a big deal in Beirut. If you were a member of the Muslim community of the United Arab Republic, you were going to be a nobody in a much larger organization. He understood that, and he used that to play with them and to appeal to them. It really is an example of the man on the scene doing the right thing. He was, of course, greatly assisted by the fact that the commander of the American Sixth Fleet, Admiral Holloway, immediately grasped that McClintock was offering a way out of putting American GIs in the middle of the Civil War, and that he should seize the whole notion of guests and hosts and adopt it and make it his. And therefore, we had the successful working of the American civilian diplomat on the scene and the ranking American military officer on the scene.
You ended your comments with a kind of discussion of how we eventually did make it to Baghdad. And obviously, that's the war that in many ways looms over the consciousness of Americans today when it comes to the use of force in the Middle East. And in the debate that I think we're having now as a result of both President Trump's decisions, whether it's with respect to northeastern Syria, whether it's with respect to the decision not to respond to the ostensibly Iranian attacks on Saudi oil facilities back in September with any military force, about the use of American military force in the Middle East. And so what are the takeaways that the policy debate that we're conducting today should really draw from your book, from this experience of 1958, when it comes to the application of military force? You talked about the Eisenhower Doctrine, the first articulation of an American vital interest in the Middle East. Several decades later, we had the articulation of the Carter Doctrine, which was the readiness of the United States to use force to protect our interests, particularly in the Persian Gulf, but with a sort of implication of a broader extension across the region. Today, we seem to be at a kind of inflection point about all of these doctrines. Do they still apply? Should they still apply? And what does 1958 have to say in the context of that debate?
Okay. Let me start with going to Baghdad. As I mentioned, Undersecretary Murphy, after they've kind of resolved the Lebanese problem, traveled on to other countries in the region, including going to Egypt to talk to Nasser, and going to Baghdad to talk to the coup leader, Lieutenant Colonel Qasem. They had, at this point, we had very little relationship with the new Iraqi government. What we knew about it was that they'd come through power in an incredibly bloody and savage coup. Murphy, of course, got clearance to fly into Baghdad. As the planes started crossing into the Iraqi border, the Iraqi Air Force came up and said, "You don't have clearance to come in." Murphy, a very brave man, said to the pilot, "Nope, we're just going to go ahead. We're going to fly into Baghdad." He got into Baghdad. He went to see Colonel Qasem. Colonel Qasem greeted him holding a machine gun on his lap, but then quickly said, "I'm an Iraqi nationalist. I don't want to be the footsie of the Soviet Union, and I'm certainly not going to give up power to an Egyptian." Many Arabs from non-Egyptian countries tend to look down upon Egyptians as peasants, fellaheen, not noblemen like them who rode around on camels. I know it all sounds ridiculous, but so do American thinkings about Alabama and Michigan and stuff like that. We all have our own prejudices. And then Murphy did something very clever. He said, "You know, I've just flown over your country. I've flown from the Jordanian border to Baghdad. I've never seen a more miserable place in the world. Why would the United States want to take over Iraq?" Qasem, who had a good sense of humor, burst out laughing. And that broke the tension in the meeting and allowed for a real dialogue to go on. It's a good example of how you can use humor if you're a diplomat, to effectively get your way. It's also an example that we really do need to listen to the other voices in the Middle East, which I think gets to your question. We can't just portray them in stark terms, black and white. We like to do that. Saddam Hussein fit that perfectly. You know, here's a really bad guy. Except that up until the night of the 1st of August, 1990, he was our guy. He was our hero. People were saying that Saddam Hussein is not only going to be the man who takes care of the Iranians, but he's going to be the man who can make peace with Israel. It all sounds ridiculous now, but that's what was widely believed in this town as late as July 1990. We need to have more nuanced understandings of all of these problems and not throw them into the pigeonholes that we like to throw them into. That, I think, is one of the great lessons of 1958. Don't assume, because the crowd has pictures of Nasser, that that means the guy running the coup is an agent of Nasserism. It's more likely to be more complicated than that. The Middle East is always more complicated than it appears to be at first order. Again, don't panic. Change the channel. Watch something else. Come back to it tomorrow. It'll probably look a lot different and a lot less simple than it appears the afternoon right after a coup d'etat.
Let me press you a little bit on that. Is the implication that, in fact, our interests today in the region are no longer as vitally concerned, that we essentially can afford to take a step back when there's chaos, when there's violence, either because we're not quite as dependent as we used to be on energy supplies coming out of the Middle East, at least not in this country, that's not true of the wider world, or because we recognize that often our first instinct to intervene is counterproductive?
Right. As I repeat myself endlessly, it's complicated. Let's go back to August 1990. I think the president very wisely chose to wait a couple of days after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait to see how the situation was going to sort itself out. Now, he's, of course, been accused by Margaret Thatcher and others of going wobbly in those days. I don't think he went wobbly. I think he did something much more astute. He waited to see what are the Iraqis really doing. And when it became apparent, as it did by the 5th of August, that the Iraqis were building up their forces to invade Saudi Arabia, which really would be a game changer in the world, that's when he sent then Secretary of Defense Cheney off to Riyadh and got the Saudis to agree to allow American forces to come in. Then again, he waited the better part of 6 months before deciding to go and to actually liberate Kuwait. It was a very thoughtful process by a president who I think we can say in retrospect was one of the most thoughtful and careful in American history. Contrast that with kind of knee-jerk decisions on other occasions, the foolhardiness of sending the Marines into Beirut in 1982 into a very complex situation in which the Lebanese army had basically ceased to exist. And we were siding ourselves on the side perceived to be siding on the sides of the Christians and the Israelis against the majority of Lebanese. It was a very foolhardy decision. In his favor, Ronald Reagan learned a lesson from that. He did go on to continue to send American troops into combat, but he learned that you should only invade really small islands in the Caribbean. That was safe and easy to do. Don't invade the landmass of Asia. And I think that's another lesson of this. Bob Gates is famous for saying that any Secretary of Defense who advocated sending American troops into the landmass of Asia should have his head examined. That phrase actually comes from Douglas MacArthur, who, having actually led American troops into the landmass of Asia, learned a lesson himself, which is that is really not a smart idea. We have interests in the Middle East. There's no question about that. But they are different today. We don't need Saudi oil like we used to. Many other countries do, and that's important to us, but we don't need Saudi oil as we used to. We don't really need to get bogged into a conflict between Sunnis and Shias. Most Americans, quite rightly, don't know what the difference between a Sunni and a Shia is. And there's a good reason for that. There really isn't any significant ideological difference between Sunnis and Shias. It's all a quarrel over who should have been the rightful heir to Muhammad 17 centuries ago. That's really not something to get up in arms and fight about today, but they are. It is sectarian conflict in the Middle East today is worse than it has ever been in modern history, and we are completely identified as being on the side of that conflict. I think the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, did us all a favor the day after the attack on Saudi Arabia by the Iranians. She didn't go to Saudi Arabia. She did go to Jordan, an American ally that's been too often neglected in this administration. And in Jordan, she pledged the defense of Jordan against ISIS. More revealingly, she said, we have no defense commitment to Saudi Arabia, and if this president decides to send American troops to fight Iran on the side of Saudi Arabia, I will take action in the House to condemn it. That's a very, very powerful statement by the leader of the Democratic Party against our oldest ally in the region. And it shows that we are in a moment of great transition in our relationship with our traditional partners in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia especially, but I would also argue Israel as well. The next year or two could see an existential crisis in our relationship with Saudi Arabia. And if Bibi Netanyahu is elected prime minister again, it's possible we could also see a crisis in that relationship too. Less likely in the Israeli case, more likely in the Saudi case.
Well, we have a few things to chew over. I'm going to pose one more question to Bruce, but then ready your own questions, because we'll be circulating mics and inviting you to put some questions to Bruce. But I couldn't conclude this part of the discussion without asking your thoughts on what's been happening today or very recently in Lebanon, also in Iraq and elsewhere across the region. The book, and as you've talked about today, really does focus on this period of grand Arab nationalism when the concept of uniting various nation states, however artificial or contrived they may have been, was the defining paradigm for those who were seeking to express a vision of Arab nationalism. Today, as you said, it has really become translated into local, much more local nationalism, and in some cases, particularly in Lebanon, a sort of rejection of the confessional power-sharing systems that were put in place either through negotiation or in Iraq, for example, after the U.S. Invasion. Can you speak a little bit about how you see these kind of expressions of nationalism playing out, the extent to which they can, in fact, overcome the existing structures of power? We may pull Tammy back into the conversation if she likes. But I think, you know, what's happening today is extraordinary, and it really does come out of a legacy of some of what you talk about in the book.
Right. It is quite amazing to see what's going on in Lebanon, and I think in particular in Iraq. This rejection of sectarianism is quite extraordinary. You often read, when you read about Beirut today, the statement that the sectarian system was created in the agreements that ended the Lebanese civil war. That's not true. The sectarian system was created by the French back at the beginning of the French mandate. They're the ones who decided that the Christians were going to be, quote, the majority. Demographically, that probably wasn't true even in 1919. It certainly wasn't true by 1958, and it is by far not the case today. Even if you don't count the 500,000 Palestinians who've been living there, in most cases, their entire life as part of the population, this was a foreign implant into Lebanon, and it survived, and it still survives today. I remain to be convinced that these movements in Beirut and Baghdad today really marked the end of sectarian politics. I think what they may mark is the overreach of Iran. You can argue, and King Abdullah of Jordan was the first to say it, that Iran is creating this archway of states, a ground corridor that leads from Beirut through Damascus to Baghdad to Tehran, kind of a bizarre form of Islamic nationalism, uniting them all together. Of course, the Iranians are, and their allies are careful not to say that the end state of this is going to be one country. But I think for many Iraqis and Syrians, it looks like their national identity is going to be subsumed into some kind of Shia hierarchy across the region. And they're rejecting that, and even Shias are rejecting that. We tend to forget that in the Iran-Iraq War, the vast majority of Iraqi soldiers who died in combat were Shias, who weren't at all appealed to by the Iranian system, in fact rejected violently against it in favor of Saddam Hussein's Iraqi nationalism. Support among the Shia community for Saddam Hussein really only ended in 1990 when we had the first Shia uprising at the end of the Operation Desert Storm. It's an interesting period. A lot of it is in transition. I mentioned earlier the American role is in transition. The region is in a profound transition. It's too soon to say, but it may turn out when we look back a decade from now that Islamic jihadism, or whatever you want to call it, reached its peak, and the fall of ISIS marked the end of Islamic jihadism as a motivating ideology in the region. Again, it's too early to say, but keep an eye on that. It may be that that trend is coming. We don't know what's going to come next. Certainly something will come next. It's not likely to be democracy and capital market, capitalism American style. It's something else. We'll see how that develops.
Great. Well, let me turn it over to all of you. We will have mics circulating, and I will take, at least at the outset, just one question at the at a time, so we have a chance for some back and forth with the audience. So do we have a mic? Here we go. How about right here?
First, thank you both very much. That was marvelous. I think I have a headache, but that was wonderful. This may be out of the scope of the discussion, but can you talk about Turkey? Does that have, well, it has a bearing on everything, but is that within your bailiwick?
I can say a little bit about it. One of the reasons why Iraq was so important to the United States in the 1950s was Iraq was the centerpiece of what we call the Baghdad Pact, which was an alliance between Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, largely to create a NATO in the Middle East against the Soviet Union. And Turkey was the key player in all of that. Eisenhower and his Secretary of State did consult with the members of the Baghdad Pact in 1958. It's interesting that both Turkey and Iran said, we're not interested, we don't want to send our troops into Iraq. Pakistan was a little more ambivalent, of course, because Pakistan's not next to Iraq. It's easy to be ambivalent. The only country in the Middle East that was hot to trot to have Iranian and Turkish troops go into Baghdad was Israel, which, of course, was also not an immediate neighbor, so it didn't really have to worry that much about it. Turkey, I think, continues to be. I know Turkey's in much disorder in this town. Mr. Erdogan is far too much like his American counterpart in much of what he does, his bullying behavior. If you haven't gone by the Willard Hotel, I wouldn't recommend it, but if you do go by, you'll see it is completely surrounded by snowplows, chained, linked to each other. Obviously, Mr. Erdogan has a lot of enemies, and he's basically in a fortress down there at the Willard Hotel, a pretty nice fortress, but still a fortress. The Turks are in particular disorder because of the Syrian-Kurdish situation. From the minute the Obama administration began developing ties to the Syrian Kurds in order to fight ISIS, those who were involved in that, like our colleague Amanda Sloat, will tell you, knew this was an unsustainable situation. We could not support the Syrian Kurds indefinitely. Not only are they geographically isolated from any seaport that we could get to them, and therefore have to support them through Iraq or Jordan, they are affiliated with the PKK, which we have regarded for good reason for a long time as a terrorist organization. Whether it still is or not is another question. Minds haven't changed in Ankara about that, and sooner or later the Turks were going to say, you've got to go. I think the way the Trump administration handled it couldn't have been done more poorly. It's hard to imagine a period of American foreign policy more dysfunctional than it is today, but that's what we got. We were going to end up in this kind of problem sooner or later. The Trump administration has just made it much worse. And frankly, right now, I don't have a clue what our policy in Syria is. Are we leaving? Are we staying? We seem to be sending, if you watch TV at night, we seem to be sending more troops in, not less troops. What are they there for? To protect the oil. Protect the oil from whom? You know, so that we can pump the oil? That's illegal. That's a war crime. It's just sad, really, to look at American foreign policy today.
Next question. Right up front. Yeah, the gentleman in the blue jacket.
Back in the 50s, the Soviet Union got involved in the Middle East, and then there was a hiatus for a long time. But now Russia, the inheritor of the Soviet Union, is back and seems to be actually quite successful in its engagement in the Middle East. And I wonder what comments you could make about that.
They are back. I myself don't lose sleep at night that Russia is now the dominant power in Syria. Russia, as the Soviet Union, was the dominant power in Syria from roughly 1952 until 1992. Syria is a lovely country, it's a beautiful country, has great archaeological sites, but it's not exactly one of the most crucial places in the world. Russia controlling Syria, okay. If Russia controlled Saudi Arabia, I would lose sleep at night. But it's not the same case. I also wonder whether Mr. Putin is making the same mistakes as his predecessors in the Kremlin, of aligning himself with a very unpopular regime. The Assad regime, even in its heyday under his father, was unpopular with the vast majority of Syrians, which see it as a minority Alawi regime trying to rule over a primarily Sunni country. Nothing in the civil war in Syria has changed Sunni opinions about the Assads. I think, if anything, it's reinforced those opinions. And then there's the next step. When the Syrian civil war actually comes to an end, if it ever comes to a complete end, who's going to rebuild Syria? Russia? Russia doesn't have the resources to do that. The United States? Why are we going to rebuild Syria under these circumstances? The Saudis? I don't think so. They got other fish to fry more important than Syria. You're going to the Putin Assad Khamenei regime that runs Syria is going to find that they're running a destroyed country with no prospects for rebuilding. And oil in Syria is a rapidly reducing entity. Syria doesn't sit on a lot of oil. The oil that Mr. Trump wants to protect isn't really that much oil. It doesn't really matter on the world stage. So, as I said, I don't lose sleep at night worrying about the Russians taking over Syria. I don't lose a lot of sleep at night anyway.
Okay. Let me take two at a time so that I can get enough of you, and we've got about 20 minutes left. So if I could take two up here in front. Looks like they're...
Thank you for a lecture. And I'm first-year students in science, and now I'm writing a paper about Iran-Iraq war back in 1980s and last 8 years. So I really want to ask, in your opinion, Iran is defensive or offensive? And how about Iraq? Because some people claim that Iraq is pursuing regional hegemon. Thank you so much.
Why don't we do both questions together?
Thank you. A friend of mine was in Beijing recently, and he met these Chinese students at Beijing University studying Arabic and Farsi and Turkish and Kurdish. And he was, and one of my thoughts is that China's push into Central Asia economically will have a big impact on the future. And so I'd like you to comment on the trends that are affecting the Middle East today and to speculate a little further what the region will look like 10 years from now.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Iran?
I will try, but really this is your show, and you, Bruce knows more about every country in the Middle East. One of the few people I know in Washington who can speak with great authority and true depth of experience and expertise on literally North Africa all the way through Afghanistan. So I work narrowly on Iran. From my perspective, you know, the sort of shift that you saw during the Iran-Iraq war when Iran successfully fended off the Iraqi invasion and managed to evict the Iraqi army, but then decided in their own hubris to try to go to Baghdad, was a shift that Iran has never really reversed, in the sense of taking on a much more offensive effort to try to not export the revolution, although that's certainly been part of the ethos of this regime, but really to consider the best defense to be a good offense. And even though, in effect, they didn't succeed with Iraq, they had to settle in 1988 for a ceasefire, in part because of American involvement, direct military involvement in that war, the muscle memory of that experience, of the shock of the invasion and the true chaos that ensued within the Iranian security establishment in the effort to try to mobilize a response to it, I think has left Iran always poised, always preferring to try to extend their influence both through ideology and trade and all of the sort of non-military means of extending influence, but also through direct engagement in the conflicts of the region. And of course, they have been given more and more opportunity to do that as a result, at least in part, again, of our own intervention in the Middle East. But I'm sure Bruce actually has much more informed views on this and everything else, so I'm going to let him back.
Thank you, Suzanne. This is why I like Suzanne to be the moderator. She was nice things about me. I want to just toy a little bit at the second question, trends in the region, and highlight one trend in particular. It's now 8 years since the so-called Arab Spring. The reason we got the Arab Spring are even more true today than they were then, with the possible exception of Tunisia. We haven't seen any progress on addressing the issues that led to all these uprisings. In fact, in many places, Egypt, for example, it is a worse dictatorship today than it was in the Mubarak era. The region is riven by sectarian conflicts. There are outsiders, the Russians, the Chinese, as you mentioned, eager to play on these cards for their own interests. While oil is less important to the United States, it's still very important to other countries. And it really is the only economic driver in the region. You know, the Saudis talk about becoming less dependent on oil, which is a worthwhile goal. But let's get serious here. Oil is the only thing Saudi Arabia has other than the Mecca and the Kaaba. And you can get only so many religious tourists to visit. You're going to end up being dependent on oil. And the same is true for Iraq. Same is true for the Iranians. Political process throughout the region is, there is no political process. Political process is going out into the street and throwing stones at people. There's very little way of venting off steam in this. I don't know whether another Arab Spring is coming, but I certainly wouldn't bet upon this being a stable part of the world. In fact, I would say that our oldest partner in the region, Saudi Arabia, is today more volatile than at any time since King Saud was removed from office by Crown Prince Faisal in 1963. The prospect for sudden change in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is today real and ever-present.
Let's try two more questions. I have this one here and gentleman in the brown coat.
So I know you said you aren't going to lose sleep over Russia and Syria, but I wonder if you see Russia's consistency in comparison to America's ever-changing policies domestically and in the region as a threat. Do you see other regimes in the Middle East seeing Russia more as a more consistent ally and thus turning to them? So outside of Syria, not just there. Thank you.
Thank you. Congrats, Bruce. Looking forward to reading this. You made a couple of references back to the 53 coup in Iran with Kermit Roosevelt and so on. I'm wondering if this event that we're talking about today, first of all, it's interesting that the cautious Eisenhower would resort to military force rather than more covert operations as he was in Syria and elsewhere. But did this invasion have anything like the resonance in the region that the 53 coup ultimately was shown to have? And how about inside the U.S. Security apparatus? Was it seen as a big success and something to serve as a model for the future?
Two very good questions. Yes, 1958 was seen as a brilliant success. Operation Blue Bat, you know, one dead. The Lebanese civil war brought to an end. The march of Arab nationalism / Soviet communist imperialism halted. Closer examination, of course, reveals that, yes, we did end the Lebanese civil war by basically abandoning the guy that we'd gone in to save, Shamoun, and replacing him with the guy who Nasser wanted to take over. But it was seen as a success, and I think that that was very important and probably played an important role in President Reagan's decision in 1982 to send the Marines back into Beirut. There was this kind of luster that we've done it once, it was easy, we can do it again. As we found out, no, we were lucky the first time, it's not easy, and it led to very disastrous consequences for us. Which gets to the other question about Russia's attraction. I think a lot of Russia's attraction in the region is simple. The Americans have the most dysfunctional foreign policy they've ever had. They have a president who his first Secretary of State described as a moron. And I suspect that a majority of his cabinet members who have left office call him a moron too. Iran. We had a perfectly functioning Iran nuclear deal. Maybe not 100% perfect, but as good as you're going to get, and we threw it away. And now we're desperate to try to figure out a policy to deal with Iran's return to the pursuit of nuclear technology. Are we going to sign the JCPOA again, changing a couple of commas or something to make it look like it's the Trump deal? This is no way to run a railroad, folks. Sliding from one error to the next, we desperately need to get our act together if we want to hopefully compete with our competitors in the region, Russia, Iran, China maybe, we're going to need to get away from our love affair with some of the dictators of the region. I don't really know what's going on between us and Erdogan. I thought they were the bad guys, but apparently they're not the bad guys. We don't seem to have a consistent policy towards Turkey at all these days. And again, we have the huge chasm between where American popular opinion, as reflected in the media, is, where the congressional majority is in the House, and where the White House is. And again, this is not how you run this country. It's just, I've worked in the White House for four presidents. You don't run the White House this way.
Okay, one last round. Let me point to Tamara, and also just all the way in the back. We'll get both corners of the room.
Thank you for indulging me. So, first on the question of Syria policy, and Bruce, I thought you described it so well. I just wanted to spotlight that Foreign Affairs Today published a fantastic article by our next door neighbor Francis Brown at Carnegie about the ambiguities and inconsistencies in our Syria policy that extended across both the Obama and Trump administrations and brought us to today. So I commend that to everyone. But I want to go back to this question of who our friends are in the region and how we decide that, because it seems to me that one of the precursors you describe to the events of 1958 was the sense in Washington that we had a chance with Nasser and we lost it, right? And that Nasser and the ideology he represented were pro-Soviet. And it may be that both of those things were a misjudgment, but those were things that drove Eisenhower going into the 58 crisis. And so here we are at a moment of transition again, where a lot of our partners in the region are talking about China and Russia and going off to Moscow and taking official visits from Beijing. And, you know, and you told us that one of the lessons from 1958 is don't panic. How should we assess whether friends or others in the region are, you know, as they might have put it in Cold War days, falling into the other camp? How do we know when we need to get in there and really try to turn the tide, and when to step back and wait?
Hi, Eric Bordenkircher, UCLA Center for Middle East Development. Bruce, I enjoyed the talk. I read the last chapter of your book over the weekend, and I was thinking about the lessons learned, and I think there was an issue that maybe could produce some further thought about, is we're always looking at the front end of these interventions, and the Lebanon situation, how it was resolved, I think is a valuable lesson learned, in the sense that in these divided societies, like Lebanon, but we're seeing it throughout the region today, where we need to interact, or we need to at least help resolve these problems at kind of the regional level, the United States and Egypt. We can look at, you know, the Taif Agreement. The Taif Agreement really was not implemented until the U.S. kind of gave the green light to the Syrians. You could look at the Cairo Agreement in 69 in Lebanon, where basically the Americans conceded to the Syrians and the Egyptians. And so I was thinking, you know, could we also, you know, does Lebanon become a valuable tool for us looking forward in the region as an example of what and maybe what not to do? Because Lebanon has a history here of 70, even predates its independence, of this interference and, you know, external interference and divided society. So that one. And then there's also another issue, too. And this has come up more recently in regards to the Kurdish issue. And I've seen it, I've been at the Reagan Library going through a lot of the documents from 82 through 84. And this issue of credibility and dealing with these problems and then kind of pulling back and also asking for help in regards to the Israelis in 82 and 83 and the withdrawal from the Shuf, I think is very interesting parallel in regards to what we're seeing in northeastern Syria today. So I guess there is a question here, you know, is there also an element of credibility? And this credibility seems to be getting us into these conflicts and making it much very difficult for us to pull out of these conflicts as well, as maybe what we're seeing here with Syria and this kind of this dance that we're having with Turkey and the YPG. So those are my two comments.
I think both of you have hit on a similar chord, which is it's easy to get in, and it's really, really hard to get out. And if there's one lesson of American combat operations in the Middle East, is that Operation Blue Bat was the anomaly. We went in easily, and we got out easily, largely because we turned the whole operation into a fiction, which was smart, but rarely are all the players going to come along and say, okay, I'll play my part too. Usually they don't want to play. And the sad history of Lebanon from 1968 on is vivid demonstration of that. I want to say one more thing about the 1958 operation. There was significant criticism inside the United States over Eisenhower's decision to send the troops in. And one of the most critical people in the United States was the then Senator John F. Kennedy, who said the administration is talking about the Middle East in Cold War terms when that's not what's going on at all. It's more complicated than this. And Kennedy espoused a rapprochement between the United States and Nasser. And for the 3 years of the Kennedy administration, the United States and Egypt actually developed not a close, warm relationship, but we stopped calling each other nasty terms all the time. That really started to change after Egypt intervened in the Yemen in 1962. But pretty much to the end of the Kennedy administration, there was an attempt by the Kennedy administration to see if we could see Nasser less as a Cold War adversary, less as the advocate of Arab nationalism, and more as what he really was, the president of Egypt, a very poor country that badly needed food from the United States, and that could be, in a way, a partner of the United States. And I think one of the problems gets right to your question, is that we tend to decide that you are either for us or against us. Well, in the Middle East, most people are both for you and against you. All depends on what thing it is you want to talk about. The Iranians are hobgoblin of evil today. In practice, we are kind of the joint owners of Iraq. You know, the fight against ISIS was a joint operation between us and the Iranians and the Iraqis. Now, neither the Iranians nor the Americans want to admit this, but that's the facts on the ground. Our number one ally in the war against ISIS was General Qasem Soleimani. He certainly doesn't want to be characterized that way. And we don't want to characterize that relationship, but the facts on the ground were like that. The Middle East is always a very, very complex place. People change alliances overnight. One should be as wary of the advice of your allies as the advice of your adversaries. We certainly found out in the 1958 crisis, I'll just say one more small footnote. While we went in to save Lebanon, our British allies intervened in Jordan and sent paratroopers into Amman to strengthen the Hashemite government of King Hussein. Of course, since Iraq and Jordan had just broken off relations, Jordan needed to get oil from somewhere. The Saudis refused to provide oil to Jordan or to the British troops fighting in Jordan. So the United States had to airlift oil into Amman. You can imagine how expensive that's going to be. And how are you going to airlift it from? The Saudis wouldn't let us use bases in Saudi Arabia, so we had to airlift it from bases in Europe. How do you get there? You have to overfly Israel. Israel wouldn't provide clearance. The Eisenhower administration basically had to promise the world and the moon to the Israelis to get overflight permission for our British ally to be resupplied, buttressing up the Hashemite regime. So here our two closest allies in the region, Israel and Saudi Arabia, were our adversary in support of our closest ally trying to keep King Hussein in power. It's my lesson. Be very leery of what your allies tell you. They've got their own objectives in mind, and many times they aren't the objectives that the United States necessarily has.
I think that's a perfect place to end, and I want to thank you all, and especially thank Bruce for helping to remind us of the importance of history. I really commend this book to all of you. It is a great read, and it is incredibly relevant to all the dilemmas that we face in the region today. So thank you all.
Thank you.